As a product manager, AI will be
a great help.
As a product person, understanding agentic AI and the arising new protocols is
going to become more and more important.
Welcome to Business Biome, the podcast that explores the interconnected world of business ecosystems, co-innovation, and new forms of collaboration to jointly solve problems too complex to solve alone. My name is Nicholas, and together with my guests, I dive deep into these fascinating concepts where corporates, startups, entrepreneurs, and even individuals interact, collaborate, and thrive together. We will uncover the secrets behind successful partnerships, explore the evolving dynamics of co-innovation, and discover how businesses can harness the power of collective intelligence. Follow me and my great guests on this promising journey.
Hey everyone, it's a new week and I have a very, very cool guest today on the show. So welcome to a new Business Biome recording. He's a strategic advisor. He's currently with Artemus. He has more than 30,000 followers on LinkedIn, which amazes me. And we had many, many good chats so far. So I'm pretty happy that we pushed the recording button today and talk about product management, the here and now, and the future. I would say, Stuart, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Nick. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm so excited. It's pretty hard for me to stay seated and not stand up. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to today's recording. But we have to start with something that I introduced the past year, and I always ask my guests two questions up front. So first of all, what are you passionate about? And the second question is, what was the most craziest thing that you've ever done?
What am I passionate about? I am a proper nerd. I can't help it. I do love product and AI, and I read all these research papers and I do all the LinkedIn posts. I don't think you could do it unless you genuinely had a passion for it. So apart from that, I love a bit of TV. I love watching my Netflix. And what's the craziest thing I've done? To be honest, it's a different question. It's what's the craziest thing you've done that you're prepared to say on a public podcast? So, that's the one I'm going for. Do you know what? I've been thinking about this recently. So over 20 years ago, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I heard somebody talking about this sort of e-commerce idea on radio, decided to quit my job and start an e-commerce company. I knew absolutely nothing. I envy that guy because I made a success of it. I envy that guy. It's almost like the less you know, the more willing you are to take diabolical chances and possibly succeed. It's like the more you know as you get older, you're like, oh, I don't know. Oh, I'm a bit cautious now, you know, which is a shame because you sort of know more. But yeah, so I'm going to go with that. It was starting that company when I knew absolutely nothing.
Brilliant. I mean, I already know, but by listening to the statement, I can tell that you have a great story to tell and bringing a lot of experience and know-how to the table. And that's what we actually need. People that share their experience around product management, around the real value in the AI and not only about hyping the technology. So I'm so excited. It's so good. So yeah, I would say let's start. We want to talk about product management today. I mean, you're acting as a fractional CPO. You have a lot of product experience. So before we look into like the future and deal with the fancy stuff, let's talk about the here and now. I mean, we both work in the product realm. We had a chat about that beforehand. What are, from your experience and perspective, currently things that go wrong in product management and product development as of today?
I thought you wanted to keep this upbeat. You're going to start with this. Okay. we'll try and keep it upbeat still. Look, I think most of it comes down to, and this is not just my past experience, but this is speaking to people that I mentor and other people in the industry. It's almost like we've still got an industrial revolution mindset. You know, where we were, oh, how productive was that chap? Well, he moved that ton of coal from there to there. So we've measured him and we can see that he's productive. And that mindset is still there, which is ludicrous when you think of, you know, product is knowledge work, and the core of it should be to be able to navigate ambiguity and complexity, which necessitates making decisions when you don't know the full picture, for example. So it becomes like sense and respond, take the next best right move, and so on. And we talk about doing that iteratively and in terms of experiments, but it's still, the folk I'm talking to, my past experiences, it's still about velocity of delivery, which is absurd, because if I have my foot, it doesn't matter how hard I press that accelerator on the car, if I'm going the wrong direction, I'm still going the wrong direction. And there's no stopping to kind of have a look at the map and reassess. And it's such a tragedy because it's, you know, in many respects, the reality is for a lot of product people is it's become perverted. You know, the idea of what product should be is fabulous, but what is the reality on the ground for what it's become for many is a bit more tragic than that. And yeah, it's a shame, but I don't have any answers as to how we're going to repair that problem.
Got it. Speed of delivery. That rings a bell. And I can fully relate to that. I mean, working with different clients, different markets, it's something that I think is quite common out there. And I had a really good chat yesterday about this aspect where the later you ship, the later you will make any revenue or potential revenue. And that's something that has to be in the minds of the people. I mean, it's not about like over-engineering stuff and being pixel perfect at the end. It's about solving a problem, and this in a very smart and fast way. And there is also a second aspect, and this is the learning aspect, I guess. The faster I deliver something, the faster I can learn and really figure out, is it the right direction? Because like you said, if you go into the wrong direction, but you keep on doing so for 8,000 kilometers, that's way worse than going into the wrong direction for 20 kilometers and then figuring out, hold on for a second, we have to go that way or make a turn right. So what are means that can be established in order to fix that issue?
Just to quickly highlight mm-hmm. something, just sparking off what you said, you know, when I think of what the core concept of being agile is, for me personally, it's the fastest route to learning. I don't know how it became, you know, almost a religion, you know, and, it, you know, you have to follow these cargo cult practices in order to be able, you know, be agile, when it's just, anyway, that's my own personal bugbear. But you mentioned very quickly the word problem. And this is the core of it for me. You know, we are living in a world of digital pollution because, and AI is actually making this worse. We're seeing this all play out again, where we're seeing technology built in search of problems to solve rather than, my wife, I was in the car with my wife and she said to me, why are there so many products built that then look for problems to solve? And I said, the problem's not the problem, that's the problem. And she actually understood what I meant by that, which is incredible. But your listeners haven't been married to me for 25 years, thankfully, so for them. But it's the rush to solutionize. It's not spending time in the problem. What's the problem? What's the context of the problem? What's the problem under the problem? Is the problem worth solving? Is the problem the real problem? Should we be looking elsewhere? You know, again, this touches on that deliver. You know, keep the engineers busy. You know, give me certainty with a fire. I mean, I can't believe it. I actually see job specifications for product people that say, we want you to come and do a 5-year roadmap for us. I don't know what it's going to be, what the reality is going to be next month, but it's this, they can't deal, the business can't deal with ambiguity and uncertainty. And people in general don't deal, and I think the best product people do deal very well with that, but it's because the business doesn't have an understanding of that, navigating that uncertainty. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, we end up with the classic feature factory, yeah. You know, and the feature factory, I shouldn't really confess this publicly, but very often I've been asked to come and have a look at a product, you know, that's not doing so well. Specifically in the startup world. And I go through the product, and I'll tell you what, 8 out of 10 times, my first recommendation to them is to scrap over half of the features. Okay. And there's, oh my goodness, that's an anathema. Yeah, but we'll lose so-and-so customer. But what about this segment? And what about that use case? And, you know, this whole adage of if you build for everybody, you build for nobody is absolutely true. And not only that, the more we increase the complexity and the feature factory status of our products, we introduce something called the dizziness of choice. I'll give you a lovely example of the dizziness of choice, right? It's actually a Kierkegaardian philosophy. But anyway, we've spoken about that before. But so what they did experimentally inside restaurants, right? So these restaurants, they had like 100 different, dishes on their menu. And there was a large degree of dissatisfaction. A lot of people coming in and then just leaving for some unknown reason. Well, somebody spotted what that was. And what they did was they got it down to 12 core dishes. They were each dishes that were already in that menu, all of a sudden user satisfaction went up, people were happier, they even thought the food tasted better. Perhaps it did because they were concentrating on cooking less. Well, that tells you something straight away. But it's this whole, you know, it's in the psychology of people to have cognitive overload when there's too much going on. And then we wonder why they abandon. Sorry, that was a bit of a sermon, but yeah, I just wanted to
I love it. I mean, gosh, how many talks did we have about, for example, like bringing an existing product onto a new tech stack with our team? And one of my first questions many, many times was, and I'm continue doing so in the future, is like, do you know how your product is used? Because everyone comes with, we need feature parity. And I'm like, why? Do you have the facts, the figures? Do you have the numbers? Why should we aim for feature parity? Maybe it's 90% of the product aren't used. So why aiming for feature parity? And then I'm asking like, okay, tell me, how do you use the product? And in many, many cases, they are like, we don't know. We had a request 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 3 years ago from different parties. And I'm like, yeah, but are they still using those functionalities?
Yeah. That we have a great saying, Nick, in the UK. It might not translate so well to non-native English speakers, but it's called keep up with the Joneses. Yep. And the essence of it is that if your neighbor buys a new sports car, you have to buy a new sports car and so on, right? But I heard somebody add to it, keep up with the Joneses, but nobody told me they were going bankrupt. Now, there's a real irony there, isn't there? When you think of feature parity with your competitors, because, oh my goodness, they brought this new AI feature out. We must copy, we must have our own. But you have absolutely no evidence what bottom line that's right, what return on investment they're getting from that. And it's that kind of fear. And it's a race to the bottom once we start this. And I get the fears. It's probably worth saying that a lot of what I talk about is being learned through doing it wrong myself. Okay, so this isn't sort of me being all lofty and because I've read books. I've learned it the hard way. I understand the fear of that feeling that you're going to leave cash on the, you're not going to get the cash because you're not serving that segment, or you're going to leave cash on the table because you haven't got that feature. But equally, when folk have taken that advice to pare it down, focus on the niche first and slowly expand, even though they've had that initial pain of perhaps losing or disgruntling some, I cannot think of a single case where it has not worked out. But those that continue adding more features, more features, more features, they simply do not succeed.
Yeah. Oh, there is so much in there. We talked about feature creep. We talked about like the validation aspect of fast delivery. And that doesn't mean that you have to deliver kind of a full-blown product. This could also mean like giving the users some artifacts, a click dummy whatsoever into their hands to really get their minds in a working state and trying to figure out whether this is the right approach. What about team setup? For example, in large organizations where you usually have like all the processes and like the heavy processes and the bureaucracy in many cases, how would you start and improve there?
The first thing to say is that every large organization wants to be like a startup, and every startup wants to be like a large organization. This is just the paradox, isn't it? And I'd also, I have this funny thing about one-liners. You'll probably get that. I just love these punchy things. I'm a simple man, so I need simple things. And I've said in the past, nobody processes their way to success, but nobody gets to success without some processes. There's always a middle ground. We tend to be very binary or extremist one way or the other. As you get older and you mellow, you tend to realize it's that nice sort of center point. You know, I have focused predominantly on startups and small to medium sized organizations because I have a low tolerance for the slow grinding wheels of very large organizations. Now, I've even been part, I was introduced into one by a chief information security officer that wanted to create a sort of internal venture studio to spin out security startups. Okay. Now, I took that on, very excited about it, but quickly realized that they were never going to set us free from their grindingly slow bureaucratic process and hierarchies. It was doomed for failure. The only way would have been to completely separate it and give it completely different rules. How do you solve these things? The thing is that we are in then a large, systemic, complex organization with massive hierarchies, full of kingdom builders, you know, and you talk to product folk, and I feel for them. I really do. They read the books, they listen to the podcast, they know, they think they know how it should be. But the reality is that, you know, like, let's take something like that, you know, this is even VPs of product, by the way, that want to do their own product strategy, you know, but then sort of everything's handed down from the heavens and they have nothing that they can do about that apart from deliver it, even if they know it's not going to deliver value. I don't really have an answer. In fact, I've become quite pessimistic. I used to post a lot on this. I don't post on it nowadays. I don't have the solutions. And I feel the pain of those that are sort of trapped inside that. But yeah, I'm sorry not to be able to kind of give a golden nugget of truth there, but it's a difficult one.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is kind of a cool story or approach. I think it was from Bayer, where they go through a really big restructuring process and they really want to become faster and get rid of a lot of overhead. I mean, it's a big step and it needs people that, yeah, burn for those decisions, because that means to change things that have been there for years and years. And it also means to cut off maybe things that feels a bit uncomfortable also for those people that actually make those decisions. But at the end of the day, it's about the survival of the business. And this counts not only for large enterprises, but also for SMBs, as you mentioned. And let's look into OpenAI or the big LLM providers versus Google. I mean, who would have guessed that the release of the LLMs would have such a huge impact on Google's business model and on Google's ads and how search is done? I mean, nobody would have guessed that. And suddenly you have a big incumbent that struggles with that. And this is, I would say, one of the best examples to be ready and to work on being agile and to really adapt to the new situation. And this means you have to work on your organization, you have to work on the processes to be able to do so, and not sitting there waiting for 3 years and then you can pull the plug because your business model is no longer needed or existing.
You named it in that discourse. You named it survival. Okay, this is the key. It has to be an existential threat. Google is a wonderful example of this, because what is effectively at stake is their core cash cow. Okay, with large language model searches and adverts inside large language models, and you know, etc. It would mean that they would need to tear in potentially to their core cash cow in order to change. Now, that is an unbelievably difficult ask, and it has to take something like an effort of survival, an existential threat. But we humans, we do love to live in denial. I'm just speaking honestly, we don't like change. Because this is the funny thing, is the technology changes faster than the organizations, because the organizations are made of humans. And humans, for very many, many good reasons, don't want the system to change. They don't want things to change. They're working out quite well. I'm in a good position. I'm paying the bills. Why would I want anything? I've got a good title. I feel good about myself. Why would I want anything? In fact, perhaps I'll subtly, actively work against that change. I'm not saying that's happening in Google, by the way, but you know, that just looking at the psychology of folk I've met over the years and challenges I've come across. So I think that the very core is that it has to be almost like first the realization, then come out of denial, the acceptance, and then the impetus. I think that AI is creating that situation, but the wrong way to go would be, because I put up a post about a CEO that was almost dumping fear on his employees about AI, and it was kind of, you know, and I felt that's the wrong way to go, because that fear base does inhibit innovation. Because ultimately, and this comes down to the original question on product as well, and this is a fundamental thing to acknowledge, is that to do product in the way that we feel it should be done, it has to be safe to fail. And very often that is not the case. And it's the same with, trying to do systemic change. You know, you're battling against the incentive structures and the people and the personalities and the kingdoms. And there has to be a very, I always remark to myself how quickly organizations and people could adapt when COVID hit. It was phenomenal. Things that would have been outrageous as a suggestion was suddenly done overnight for survival reasons, and done, perhaps not perfectly, but done fantastically, you know, and certain bureaucracies and red tape and things were pushed out of the way to just make it happen. And that's because there was a kind of existential pressure to do that. And until businesses, and I'm sorry to say that many will not even realize they're in an existential crisis until it's too late. And Vim Vashishta calls those zombie organizations. And I believe we are in the current process of witnessing many, many zombie organizations that don't even know they're dead yet.
Talking about change.
I'm not keeping this on an upper at all, am I? Keep it positive, he said to me. That was the rule.
I mean, let's be honest, in order to change things, we can't skip like the issues and the problems. But if you're willing to change, I mean, how many times did you went through change over the past years? And same I did. And we are still in there. Let's talk a bit about the turnaround. Product building and product management of the future. I mean, you post a ton on AI, which is cool stuff. It's great to follow. It's not like here's a paper or a cool video. So you always put some experience or your own view or interpretation in there, which is quite cool. And that's needed, because it's not about following a blueprint and mechanisms that may work for others but may not work for yourself or for your own organization. So the future, what role does AI already play but will also play in the future of the day-to-day work of product managers and product people in general?
I don't know about you, but it must be a daily occurrence now that somebody slides into my DMs telling me that they're building a new piece of AI for product managers, and would I be so kind as to test it out? Well, actually, I've stopped doing that largely, and the reason is because on 90% of them, I sit there thinking, could do that in ChatGPT. Actually, I think that's the differentiation and the distinction they should be focusing on. Why can't I just go and do this? Because that's the first question that comes up with any AI product tool or software, because it's, well, I can go to ChatGPT and do that. That's probably aside. I'll talk personally, rather than, you know, sort of pontificate about what others may or may not be doing. I want to qualify what I'm about to say by saying this oddly, which is that AI is the most amazing, Gen AI specifically, I'll try and be specific, is the most amazing and breathtaking to those that are not domain experts in what they're using it for. Prime example, I'm terrible at coding. Oh gosh, I don't know what it is. I don't have the brain for it. Okay. Now, when I first start using an AI coding tool, it's like having superpowers. It's like, wow, look what I can do. That's it. Now I want to jump on LinkedIn and declare the death of developers. That industry's cooked. It's over. Look what I've done. You know, in fact, as a product person, forget about UX, forget about developing, forget about marketers. I can do it all. I'm amazing. But the truth of the matter is that I'm not expert enough in these specific domains to know if the quality is truly good. So with regard to specifically code, can it scale? Is it secure? I don't know. Is it well written? I have no idea. You know, I don't know what's going to break tomorrow if I try to do something else. Now, actually, the reverse of that is that AI is the most powerful in the hands of those domain experts. I'm not going to call myself an expert. I'm too old to do that now because I always feel like in the end, it's like, oh, I didn't know that. But, you know, like, for example, product, I feel I have a relatively good grounding in it. And, you know, if I'm going to use it to help me put together a product strategy or something like that, you know, it's fantastic not to have to start from a blank sheet. It's fantastic to get that kickstart, head start. Very often, you know, as long as you engage with it in the right way, it even gives you things you hadn't considered and you think, yeah, that's great. But equally, I'm then going to pore over it, change a lot of it, get rid of the stuff that's nonsense and inject my own experience, my own domain experience into it. And I think that's where the power lies. It's funny, just quickly talking, it's just something that was on my mind, talking about product strategies very quickly. You know, the heart of the problem, a lot of the time with product strategies specifically, and if you do it on AI, it's about context. AI doesn't necessarily know the context, and why would it? If I say to you, hey, Nick, you know, give me a product strategy for this product and don't really tell you about the product, the market, the constraints that I'm in, the resources I have, you could try and put something together. And then I go, that was rubbish, Nick, you know, because I haven't given you all the information that you need. And very often, product strategy, in my opinion, should ladder up to the business strategy, the overall business strategy. It needs to tie in with those business drivers. Do you know what? Half the time, that's actually missing, or they're flip-flopping it all the time. Unfortunately, it's the product folk that kind of get blamed for, well, that product didn't deliver to the business. I don't know why I mentioned that. I think you triggered mm-hmm. something earlier. So yeah, when I think of things, and I do want to emphasize this, because I'm not an expert in those domains, and I want to emphasize that point of them wanting to jump on LinkedIn and declare the death of the UX industry or some such thing, you know, it's nonsense. And I wish we could stop it, because all it does is reveal your lack of knowledge in that domain, in my opinion. Will it change that industry? Will it augment that industry? 100%. 100%. It does. I use it all the time. I absolutely love it. But as I say, it has to be in the hands. So you can't just go build me a roadmap, because the problem with that is that everything coalesces. If I'm doing it, somebody else is doing it, and everything coalesces to this sort of middle ground. And actually, you don't want to be in that middle ground. You want to be in the exceptional. And unless you can inject it with a lot of experience and know-how, knowledge and context, then you're probably going to go awry with it.
I see it identical. And I mean, I came across your post. I think I also put a comment underneath it regarding we all going to die. We're going to be replaced by that piece of tech. And I'm at the moment, I'm also quite sick of that because it creates fear instead of making the people think about how it affects their role and which potential it bears. I mean, how many times did I talk to our developers and they were like, oh, it's so, we have to deal with XYZ again and with this and the documentation and that. And now you have, like you said, especially GenAI that helps a lot with that. So now they can focus on the rocket science side of things and now have time for that and get a lot of help on the stuff they don't like to do. And I fully understand it. It's boring stuff that you have to do in many of these cases, or it's like repetitive tasks. Go and build some piece of tech for that and come up with a tool that saves time so that people can focus on the stuff that brings value and that creates a USP at the end, because if I'm lost in like the basics and the groundwork, then I don't have time to talk about the USP and the value, the high value that I can provide. So yeah, I mean, I just to state an example, if we get a request building a product, helping out with product strategy, I use AI a lot, because I currently do that with product requirements documents, and this is not about waterfall, and I need a structure where I have the big vision, the goals, the high level features, maybe some UX and UI recommendations regarding the design, and then work from there. So it helps me and also our team to align on things that are stated in 20 different documents and that don't follow the structure we are used to, because we have I posted also about this on LinkedIn. We have a structure we make use of, and it's reflected in Notion, and it's reflected in on the Miro boards. So I dump in the material that I have, and I get pretty good results out of it, and it makes us so fast.
And that's exactly, you mentioned things like boilerplate and repetitive, and these are exactly the things that this is fabulous at, that stuff. The dream is, of course, is that it releases us from that to focus on those higher order things, the places where we're not, you know, we're better at than perhaps the large language model is better than. There is a cruel irony in what's happened to, going right back to the beginning, what's happened to product. Because if you look at what's happened to product management, in a sense, because of what it's become very task oriented and very sort of boilerplatery, it actually makes it ripe for disruption with AI. And that's a kind of cruel irony of this. If it's all about delivery and it's all about, yeah, I see roadmaps as something completely different to, I think, most people. I see them as communication tools. I see them as how, and there should be different roadmaps for different stakeholders. You know, of course your engineering one's going to be very granular down to the bits and bobs. But, you know, as you go higher and higher, it's going to become more abstract. And you know, it's, but if it's just about, right, plot me a roadmap from here to there, and, you know, and that's going to be the end of the story, then, okay, then AI can do that. You might as well go home. And I think that's the sort of juxtaposition with all of this and the kind of what we're going to crash into. I'm very bullish on AI, you know, and you know what? I'm actually very hopeful, not just for product management, but for UX as well. By the way, and I did a podcast during the week with Brian T. O'Neill, the UX, AI UX chap. I was a bit nervous about doing that because he's just so knowledgeable. But I think he appreciated that I was kind of not a UX person. And I was saying, I know the UX community have been in the doldrums, they've been down, and you can understand why, because again, they're being sidelined and the product's going to take it over, or has taken them over, or whatever. Everything that shouldn't happen, should be equal partners in this. You know, but UX in AI and agents and all the rest of it, I think UX is going to go to a prime spot, a prime position, because those now the UX, and I'm no expert, I don't know how it's going to be done, but those that now the UX are going to allow this technology to become ubiquitous and completely, you know, available to the hands of everybody. There's a lot of complexity in what I just said there. So I know I just glossed over it, and people might say, my goodness, everybody's using it anyway. Actually, it's a small, we're just steeped in that world. So we think everybody's like us. But, you know, UX in terms of what is going to be asked of it is going to push them right to the top again. And it's not a simple matter of, oh, well, I've got an AI tool and I do product. Now I'm going to do Figma or I'm going to do UX or whatever. It isn't, and it shouldn't work like that. Perhaps it would be a good thing for this industry.
100%. I mean, speaking about a couple of requests that we had, what enables me as a product person also, and you already stated it, to improve the communication. So we get a product request. I work out the PRD. We share it. We work on it. We raise questions. We come up with assumptions. And then there's also one thing that I do is usually creating a mock of a possible front end, because having something that I can grasp and put on the table, even if it's digital, It's a matter of easing out the communication with the team. We don't have to talk about, yeah, okay, we need another section for the social proof and we need a call to action and there you have the login and the sign up and yada, yada, yada. So all the basics are already there and we can really work out the differentiators and the cool and fancy stuff. Not talking about building something that's not of need, but to think about, okay, is this the right approach to present it? Is it a proper user flow? Do we have to arrange stuff? So it's again a matter of speed and a means of easing out the communication.
Yeah, that ability to use it for mock-ups, POCs, experimental things that you can launch to see what kind of feedback you'll get, even if it's just a front page or what is absolutely gold dust, isn't it? And as you rightly said, if you look at a PRD, you won't necessarily get the feel for what the product is or what the product can do. But if you can use AI to skin up something in Figma that kind of, you know, is slightly interactive and you can present that to stakeholders, you can communicate that value far easier. They're not going to go through every Jira ticket and, you know, sort of get their head around it. So it largely remains in your own head. But it's the way as a tool to experiment and to communicate. And I do love it for that. I do. And of course, surfacing patterns. I mean, I feel like I wouldn't want to do like a user call, you know, like sort of probing on their use without now sort of capturing the conversation in text form through AI and then filtering that through AI to pick up. Very often it picks up nuances and things I didn't spot. And especially if you've got quite a collection of interviews and you bring those all together and it can pick out the key things, perhaps things that you didn't think, didn't spot, didn't hear. It can be quite remarkable. And I applaud the technology for that. I do.
Absolutely. I mean, that reminds me of me sitting here. I think it was past week. And we got a request and I was like, oh, let's create a PRD for that to have the structure and to get a better understanding. But I was too lazy to type. So I dumped in the documents and the material that I got. And I was using the voice mode in ChatGPT.
Oh, I tried it and it converted everything I said in English to Welsh. I really wanted to try that feature. And for love nor money, I have tried absolutely everything you can imagine. It comes up on the screen in Welsh and gives me everything in Welsh. Why? Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. I'd love to use it.
It eases out the whole process. So I had the document at the end and I could adjust things and even the user flows as mermaid diagrams that I could copy and paste over to Notion and have it there in the preview. And I just worked out, hey, this doesn't make sense. I need another statement here. There is a requirement and it's so great. And there is actually a second thing I started to use constantly. And I have to, it's time for a shout out to Alexander Hipp because he posted about that just recently, is doing like basic user research. So he used deep research and crawled through G2, Captera, I think Reddit, maybe Stack Overflow, whatsoever, to collect information and requirements and actually real quotes of users out there. And it's not the end of the story. You shouldn't stop there. But it's a means of getting a first and pretty cool understanding of the needs out there. And then from there, you can start digging even deeper. And I tried it a couple of times now. And in some cases, it takes the AI or the tool 30 minutes, sometimes even longer. But you get a pretty cool result with the deep links, jumping into the forums, looking through the whole conversation, what's good, what's bad about that. Fabulous.
Love that use case. Another thing I very much enjoy, and of course some controversy in the past, is the use of synthetic users.
Oh,
as now let me qualify this. See, the problem comes because you know, some thought that this was all about replacing human researchers. It's not. It's just that jumping off point. It's that sanity check. Am I going in the right direction here? Now, I actually put up some research that rebuffs that actual statement, because they noticed an irony with synthetic users, that they tend to be very happy, positive and jolly, whereas in reality, us humans were all miserable and conflicted. And which really made me laugh. But actually, it induced a lot of comments with people saying, yes, we've seen this problem anecdotally through using things like, synthetic focus groups. So we what they do is they actually prompt in a bit of misery and a bit of depression and things like that. It's very intriguing, amazingly intriguing. I was very surprised people were doing that, but it was a great, great thinking. And they get real benefit, but it's to get you a certain way there. It's not because you want to replace a whole group of experts that's taken them a lifetime to earn their craft. My goodness, no. But it is as I said, that sanity check. And also, as I said before, that kind of, oh, I didn't spot that. Yeah, of course. Moments that you can have with it. So yeah.
Love it. Yeah. Love it. Act as a sad user of our tooling.
Yeah. Yeah. Be a little bit depressed and angry today. You know. Fabulous.
Make use of swear words.
Yeah, you got it.
Love it. But I mean, that's what we have to deal with and work on today. I mean, there is one aspect or a couple of aspects, and I would love to hear your opinion and your experiences on that. I mean, you post a lot about AI agents, the potentials, like also the risks that are currently in there, because there are still some security issues and flaws people need to be aware of, especially from the arising protocols. But what's your view on people that currently have a product out there or want to release a product? What about the agentic realm? What about the new protocols?
Let's remember, this is nascent. We're right at the beginning of this. You know, we've been dealing with, technologies, digital technologies for the last 20 odd years, or at least I have, my goodness. And there has been time for maturity of protocols and interoperability and frameworks around governance and security. We haven't got it perfect. Of course we haven't. But there are practices and codes of practices in place to help us plug these things together in a relatively secure way. Now, bear in mind, I was in cybersecurity for 15 years. So I do have a jaded view of all of this. But what's worrying me, we need these protocols. We need them standardized as quickly as possible, simply so that we can build and scale. That's the simple thing, that they can be secure, that they can talk to one another, that they can do so in a secure way, and they can undertake operations on our behalf. Because in order for agents to be truly powerful, we're going to have to give them admin-like privileges to many of our applications and many of our personal things. And you probably saw with Visa and others that are experimenting with agents being able to perform financial transactions for us. Okay. Now, my concern is it's a bit like the Wild West of the internet when kind of back in the sort of early 2000s at the moment. I had my e-commerce business back then, and I look back and shudder. I was taking clear text credit cards, and I was taking orders on the phone as well, and they were there was no security. I mean, when I got into cybersecurity after that, and people said to me, what do you do for a living? I said, cybersecurity. I used to have to explain what that was. Okay, that's how far back in the Jurassic period we're going. We are very much similar now to where we, to then as we are now with agents. And it's this, what's troubling me is it's this, I applaud people experimenting. And I tell you what, in this last week, I've talked to some people and seen some things that they're building with agentic that really gave me a massive degree of even more bullishness over this technology. It was phenomenal. Okay. But we're still, if you look at the digital world, like we're still, although you hear about the sophisticated hackers that took down this giant organization, when you actually know what you're talking about and you read the details, you'll find they left a forgotten server online. Nobody remembered it. So-and-so had left years ago. The hackers found it and they got into it that way because it was all connected to the internal corporate network. Now we're starting to see agents discoverable on the web through search engines like Showdown. Okay. Now, these agents also have those admin privileges and can execute functions at that level, and they're just sitting there. Now, the hacking world is picking up on this, and that's both the good and the bad, sadly. And so there is an awful lot that I do sort of, that because of those that cybersecurity experience, I'm like, whoa, careful, folks, careful. But I understand the impetus to just want to go and do it, but I want it done in a safe way. And so the MCP protocol was very, very exciting. I read an awful lot of research. I'm going to say right now, I've never built anything production with it. I won't claim to do what I haven't done. I have played with it and I read a lot of research about it. And I did wonder about it from a security vantage. And I did put up a post a couple of weeks ago. There is a phenomenal attack surface, and where things can go wrong, it's around governance and security. And there are many, many, many ways that can be manipulated by those that don't have our best interests at heart, attacking those that are building with this technology. Will this be sorted out? Of course it will. But we just need that sort of deep breath and caution as well. So I'm always trying to thread this line, Nick. As you know, we've spoken enough. I'm hugely bullish on this technology. I've staked my career on it. I'm on a podcast talking about it. You know, this is I'm talking to people that I've been building it, and you know, so it's kind of, you know, it's everything to me. And that's why I try and thread this line of between hype and doom. We get the hypesters, we don't need to talk about them anymore. And there's the doomers that are kind of completely the opposite. As always, there's a nice middle ground here to be had, that sort of, you know, less binary thinking. But I do still urge caution. Do I think that should inhibit innovation and experimentation? No way, you know, but just you need an extra layer of thinking if you're going to go to real life production. If we are going to give these agents access to financial instruments on our behalf, they may take decisions that are life altering. I know that sounds absurd, but that is what I believe is going to become the case in the not too distant future. And we do need, and I won't even go on about the psychological and anthropomorphic problems, but you know, these are things that we need to consider as humans and psychologically. This is not all about technology. And I think the core of that is product as well. You know, again, it's like, if I always run, I'm a simple man, so I have these simple narratives. If we focus on technology, we end with more technology. If we focus on the business and customers, we end with more business and customers. I have these kind of very simple things. I look through the triad of feasibility, viability, desirability. I have to keep these frameworks and things simple so that I can get very clear, you know, clarity on what I'm looking at. And so it's just that, you know, be bold, but be cautious as well. But it is the trajectory that we're on, I believe.
Great statements. Kind of a funny story. I came across the news this morning. I posted it on LinkedIn that Genesis Global, they announced that they built MCP in their current release. And my first thought was like, did they consider everything like they have to do on the security side of things? They cover it in the release notes, so I'm quite happy about that they are quite transparent about it. But it's things you have to deal with, so you have to keep the balance between dealing with the new, being innovative, supporting the new, versus not rushing into like issues like you just highlighted. But one thing that made me, like, when the agents appeared and the protocols appeared, that made me really, really happy, and I felt like a little bit of a relief. So we've been working on a project with a bigger enterprise, establishing the composable enterprise. So having like business capabilities, small software assets, productize them and provide them within the enterprise for other teams. Because what happens in many cases, you build stuff 10 times in a different way. You have to build it, you have to maintain it. And at the end, maybe also some of your end users or even customers get confused because you have now this billing system and that, and you have to deal with this, and you get an ID from there, but similar case on the other side, and the other tool that you get, or the SaaS application, and you get another ID and a new login. And we had to deal with a lot of struggles like discoverability, then the interoperability of those capabilities. And when the agents came up and the protocols, I was like, oh, that's the missing piece. That's what I've been waiting for. So I'm fully with you. I'm also reading a lot about that. And we actually think about looking into MCP more deeply in one of the projects because it's a cool use case. We are asked to build a management solution and interfaces or APIs for a hardware vendor. And I was like, okay, there's a lot of data in the persistence, and why not making this accessible via MCP? So yeah, I think there's a lot of good happening, there's a lot of bad happening, but I think, and I hope you agree, that it's time to look into what's happening there and trying out things and rethinking the own product, how to support agents, how to maybe create parts of the product or transform it into an agent, how to support these protocols. That's at least my ask. I'm not sure how.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. No, I'm completely with you. I'm so bullish on agents. I try not to veer into hype. And it raises some very, very interesting questions with interoperability, because we used to, and this also touches on the product and the UX side, we used to create products and models for human consumption. Now we are creating models for models consumption. You know, this is a brand new paradigm. The consumer of that information is another model. And it also raises interesting questions around, we know that as complexity grows, there is a tendency for cascading failure modes. One of the reasons for, one of the ways to combat that is to have specialized agents in their task, in their domain, rather like we would with humans. And that makes perfect sense from a sort of, an intuitive standpoint. The thing is that if you hand me information for me to work on, I'm probably going to make the assumption you knew what you were doing, and it's probably fairly accurate. We need those same checks and balances between agents, because at the moment, information gets passed from one to the other and is just accepted as is. And then the next task is kicked off. And that's what causes that cascading failure problem, because it may have a 1% problem on the first agent, but then it starts to multiply as it goes down that chain. And so these protocols are going to be absolutely vital for these kind of checks and balances, as well as talking and discovering each other, and then doing business with each other, I'm excited about technology for the first time in 20 years. So that gives you an idea.
I think we share that excitement. And I think there is also a pretty good example to that at the beginning with the prompting, where that was quite new to everybody, where you could figure out like what the initial task was for a large language model. You could figure out the persona, maybe some do's and don'ts and the rules that were baked into the tooling. And now you have guardrails where you can avoid that somebody figures out what the tool actually is asked to do. We were happy about those guardrails because we, like you maybe saw on LinkedIn, we brought a digital twin or a clone of Einstein back to life. And the first thing that happened on the booth at CloudFest was people asking him exactly that. Hey, what's your task? What are the rules that you're equipped with? What's the stuff that you are not allowed to talk? And we were so happy that those guardrails were in place.
Oh, yeah. We're a deviant bunch, us humans, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're a curious and deviant bunch. And I'll make this clear as well, is that there is only one way for me to make your server 100% secure, and that is to encase it in concrete and throw it in the deepest part of the ocean. And this is all about risk appetite, of course. So people always going to be ingenious enough to break these guardrails, and it will be that game of whack-a-mouse for as long as this technology exists, just like in the security world. But the, you know, the idea is to put robust enough guardrails in so that it gets rid of those the low hanging fruit and those opportunists and those people that are going to just have a laugh and have a try, so they move on to something else because they get bored because they can't break it, you know. But those that are heavily resourced and highly skilled are always going to find a way to break it.
Yeah.
But you know, we have our due responsibility to have kind of at least, you know, got it raised the bar. Let's put it that way, because humans will be humans.
Yeah, that, I mean, it was so fun to see and hear. And I was like, hold on for a second, because I was standing right next to the screen and the microphone. And I was quite surprised. I shouldn't have been surprised, but yeah. But I was really happy, and I was waiting for Einstein to reply. And I was like, oh, whew. Good job, team. So,
yeah.
Good. Hey, oh, it was such a pleasure to talk with you and to touch base on the here and now, and then also on the future. Is there before we come to the last task for you? Is there anything like a final statement that you want to make, kind of, or a recommendation that you want to shout out?
No, not particularly. It's funny, I was asked this on another podcast, and I don't really have anything, but I will say, just stay curious. I would make one ask of leadership folk, and that is, don't scare people that their jobs are going to be taken by a technology and then ask them to adopt that technology, because that is not going to work, folks.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, it's like if you walk that path, you will fall off the cliff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Now walk the path.
You know,
that's
come on.
Like weird. Great statement. There is before we like close the session or the recording, there is one final ask for you. And what I usually do is that I start a sentence and I ask my guest to finish the sentence. So. You can take a second and think about it. Let's start with the first one. As a product manager, AI will be
a great help.
Love it. Second one, as a product person, understanding agentic AI and the arising new protocols is
going to become more and more important.
Perfect. Thanks a lot. Stuart, that was a great session. I had a lot of fun and a lot of aha moments. Thanks a lot for being with me. Thanks a lot for sharing your mind, your experience. That was really great.
Thank you for having me, Nick. I knew it would be a pleasure, and it was. Thank you.
Yeah, and to our audience, don't forget to follow Stuart on LinkedIn. He's sharing a lot of great content. Follow the podcast to not miss out. New episodes, and yeah, thanks for listening, and see you kind of, or talk to you, and the next time.
If you're hearing this message, it means you have listened to our new episode until the end. For that, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. If you have any questions about the topics discussed today, or if you want to follow our projects, you can find us on the web at futurebrains.io, and of course on LinkedIn. I hope you enjoyed this talk as much as I did. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a new episode. I would also appreciate a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. Please also share this episode with your network. Also, let me know what topics I should cover in the future. See you next time on the Business Biome Podcast.